Or create more. Without rethinking it, I hurry across the house, grab my phone, and dial Trent Turner's number, which I now know by heart. The phone rings 3 times before I glance at the clock and realize it's almost midnight. Not at all a proper hour to be calling a near stranger. My mother would be aghast. If you want to win the man's cooperation, this isn't the way to do it, Avery, has just gone through my head when a thick, drowsy,
"Hello, Trent Turner,"
confirms that I have, indeed, rousted him from bed. That's probably why he answered the phone without checking to see who it was. "Tennessee Children's Home Society," I blurt out, because I calculate that I have about 2.5 seconds before he comes to his senses and hangs up.
"What?"
"The Tennessee Children's Home Society. What does it have to do with your grandfather and my grandmother?"
"Miss Stafford?"
Despite the formal form of address, his thick, sleep-laden tone makes the greeting sound intimate, like pillow talk. A heavy sigh follows, and I hear bed springs creaking. "Avery. It's Avery. Please, you have to tell me. I found something. I need to know what it means." Another long exhale. He clears his throat, but the voice is still deep and drowsy.
"Do you have any idea what time it is?"
I glance sheepishly at the clock, as if that somehow excuses my bad behavior. "I apologize. I didn't notice until after I'd dialed."
"You could hang up."
"I'm afraid if I did, you'd never answer again." A little chuckle cough tells me I'm right.
"True enough."
"Please listen to me. Please. I've been digging around the cottage all evening, and I found something, and you're the only one who can tell me what it means. I need to know what's going on and what I should do about it." If there's a scandal somewhere in our family's past, it's quite possible that it no longer matters, except perhaps to a few well-preserved members of the Old Guard Gossip Brigade, but there's no way to judge that until I know what I'm dealing with.
"I really can't tell you that."
"I understand your promise to your grandfather, but..."
"No."
He suddenly sounds wide awake. Wide awake and in control.
"I mean, I can't tell you. I've never looked in any of the envelopes. I helped Granddad get them to the people whose names were on them. That's all."
Is he telling the truth? It's hard for me to imagine. I'm the type who carefully peels the tape off the wrapping paper and peeks at the Christmas presents the minute they show up under the tree. I don't like surprises. "But what were they about? What did it have to do with the Tennessee Children's Home Society? Children's homes are for orphans. Could my grandmother have been looking for someone who was given up for adoption?" As soon as I suggest it, I'm afraid I've said too much. "That's just a theory on my part," I add. "I don't have any reason to think it's true." I'm better off not opening the door to a potential scandal. I don't know that I can trust Trent Turner, though it takes a man of integrity to live with sealed envelopes for months on end. The elder Mr. Turner must have known that his grandson was made of solid stuff. The phone goes silent and stays that way so long that I wonder if Trent has abandoned the call. I'm afraid to speak. Afraid anything I say might tip the balance one way or the other. I'm not terribly accustomed to begging, but finally I whisper, "Please. I'm sorry we got off on the wrong foot this afternoon, but I don't know where else to go from here." He takes in air. I can almost see his chest filling.
"Come over."
"What?"
"Come over to the house before I change my mind."
Stunned silence is all I can manage in response. I'm not sure whether I'm excited or scared to death, or if I'm crazy for even thinking about visiting a stranger's house in the middle of the night. On the other hand, he is a reputable and well-known businessman on the island. A businessman who now knows that I've unearthed at least some part of a secret. His grandfather's deathbed secret. What if there's a sinister intention behind this midnight invitation? No one will even know where I am. Who can I tell? I can't think of anybody I'd want to let in on this right now. I'll leave a note. Here in the cottage. No, wait. I'll send myself an email. If I go missing, that's the first place they'll check. The thought feels melodramatic and silly. And then again, it doesn't. I'll grab my keys and...
You won't need your car. I'm four cottages down.
You're right in the neighborhood? Parting the kitchen curtains, I try to see through the wall of yaupon and live oak. All this time, he was practically next door?
It's quicker by the beach. I'll turn the back porch light on.
I'll be right there. I rattle around the cottage looking for a flashlight and batteries. Fortunately, whatever relatives have been using the place did leave the basics. My phone rings as I'm thumb-typing an email to myself, documenting my whereabouts and my time of departure. I jump at least 3 feet, then land hard in a pit of dread. Trent changed his mind already? But the phone number is Elliot's. I'm too wound up to calculate what time it is in Milan right now, but no doubt he's working.
I was tied up when you called yesterday. Sorry, he says.
I figured. Busy day?
Rather, he says vaguely, as usual. In his family, the women aren't interested in business. How are things on Edisto?
Honestly, the grapevine in our family is better than microchip tracking. How did you know I was here?
Mother told me, he sighs. She'd been over to Drayden Hill to get a baby fix, since your sister and Courtney and the boys are visiting. Now she's on the grandkid kick again.
Elliot is understandably frustrated.
She reminded me that I'm 31 already, and she's 57, and she doesn't want to be an old grandmother.
Uh-oh. I wonder sometimes what it'll be like to have Bitsy as a mother-in-law. I love her, and she means well, but she makes Honeybee look subtle.
Can we book your sister and the triplets to go stay at Mother's for a few days? Elliot suggests ruefully. Maybe that'll cure her.
Even though I get the joke, it stings. I adore the triplets, even if they are little wild men.
You could ask.
Despite the fact Elliot and I have only talked about kids as an eventual part of our life plan, he's already concerned that multiple births run in my family. He doesn't think he could handle more than one at a time. Every once in a while, I worry that having kids someday might be never for Elliot. I know we'll work these things out as we go. Don't most couples have to?
So how long are you at the beach?
He says, changing the subject.
Just a couple days. If I stay any longer, Leslie will send someone to hunt me down. Well, Leslie is looking out for your best interests. You need to be seen. That's the reason you moved home.
I moved home to look after my dad, I want to say. But with Elliot, everything is a step toward something. He's the most achievement-oriented person I've ever met.
I know, but it's nice to have a little breather.
You sound like you could use one, too. Get some rest while you're over there, okay? And don't worry about your mother and the grandkid thing. She'll be focused on something else tomorrow. We say goodbye, and I finish the precautionary email to myself. If I'm never heard from again, someone will eventually check there. Midnight, Tuesday evening. I'm going four doors down from the Edisto cottage to talk to Trent Turner about something involving Grandma Judy. Should be back in an hour or so.
leaving this message just in case. It feels dorky, but I send it anyway before slipping out the door. Outside, the night is quiet and deep as I walk the path through the dunes, shining my flashlight to keep a lookout for snakes. Along the shore, most of the cottages have gone dark, leaving only the glow of a full moon and a smattering of lights that seem to float over the watery horizon. Leaves and seagrass whisper, and on the beach ghost crabs scuttle sideways through the sand. I sweep the light over them, taking care not to ruin the feeding frenzy by stepping on someone. The breeze slides along my neck and through my hair, and I want to walk and relax and enjoy the soothing song of the sea. I own meditation music that sounds like this, but I seldom take time for the real thing. Right now, that seems like a shame. I'd forgotten how heavenly this place is. A perfect meeting of land and sea, undisturbed by giant high-rises or bonfires and ATVs. I come to Trent Turner's cottage before I want to. My pulse quickens as I slip along a well-worn trail through shrubbery and cross a short boardwalk to a leaning gate. His cottage is of about the same vintage as Grandma Judy's. It sits on short stilts on a large lot with a small outbuilding in the side yard. A stone path leads to the porch steps. Overhead, moths flutter in circles around a single bulb. Trent answers the door before I can knock. He's wearing a faded T-shirt with a tear along the neck and sweats that sag around his hips. His suntanned feet are bare, and he's sporting an impressive case of bedhead. Crossing his arms, he leans against the doorframe, studying me. I'm suddenly all hands and feet, like an adolescent on a first date to the middle school dance. I don't know what to do with myself.
I was starting to wonder, he says.
Whether I was coming, you mean?
Whether the phone call was just a bad dream.
But his lips curve upward, and I gather that he's joking. Even so, I blush a little. This is such an imposition. I'm sorry. I just really... I need to know. What was your grandfather's association with my grandmother?
Most likely, he was doing a job for her.
What kind of job? He looks past me toward the tiny cabin tucked beneath the trees in the side yard. I sense the struggle in him. He's wrestling with whether or not he's betraying the deathbed promise.
My grandfather was a finder.
A finder of what?
People.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Before We Were Yours by Lisa Wingate. Read for you by Emily Rankin and Catherine Tabor.
Chapter 14. Rill. It's getting on toward dark by the time the viewing party slows down, and the workers start gathering kids to put them into cars and take them back home. By then, I almost don't want to go. All afternoon, there have been cookies and ice cream and licorice whips and cake and milk and sandwiches and coloring books and new boxes of Crayola colors and dolls for the girls and tin toy cars for the boys. I'm so stuffed I can hardly move. After 3 weeks of not enough food, this place tastes better than anything. I feel bad that Camellia is missing it all, but then I don't know if she would put up with it either. She doesn't like to be cuddled or touched. I steal a cookie for her and slip it in the front pocket of my pinafore dress, and hope nobody checks us over before we leave. The people all call us dearie and sweetie pie and oh precious. So does Miss Tan while we're here. Just like at the bookmobile, she tells tales that aren't true. Her eyes twinkle and she smiles, like she's enjoying getting away with it. Just like at the bookmobile, I keep my mouth shut about what is true. They're perfect in every way, she says to the guests over and over. Wonderful physical specimens and mentally advanced for their ages as well. Many come from parents with talents in music and art. Blank slates just waiting to be filled. They can become anything you want them to be. He's a fine little thing, isn't he? She asks a man and a wife who have been holding onto Gabian all day. They've played ball and cars, and the man tossed Gabby in the air while he giggled. Now that it's time to leave, the lady doesn't want to give Gabby back. She walks all the way to the front door, and my baby brother holds on around her neck, just like Fern is holding on around mine.
On a day,
Gabby whines. We gotta go. I shift Fern to my other hip as Mrs. Pulnick tries to shoo us forward onto the porch. I don't blame Gabby for fussing. I hate that we have to go back to Mrs. Murphy's house, too. I'd rather watch Fern read some more books with the nice lady. But the lady left just a little while ago with her mister. She kissed Fern on the head and said, We'll see you soon, dearest. Before she handed Fern to me. Gab... I stopped myself just before saying the name that'll get me popped in the head at Mrs. Murphy's house, if Mrs. Pulnick hears me. Robbie, you can't stay here. Come on now. We need to find out what happened to Huckleberry Finn and Jim once they got downriver to Arkansas, remember? I stretch out one arm to him, because the other's holding Fern. Gabby won't come, and the woman won't let go either. We'll read the book when we get back to Mrs. Murphy's. Tell the nice lady goodbye.
Silence!
Miss Tan looks my way with fire in her eyes, and I pull back, letting my arm drop so quick it makes a loud slap against my leg. Miss Tan smiles at the woman, then swirls a finger in Gabby's hair.
Isn't our little Robbie adorable? So charming.
Just as quick as she got mean, she's friendly again.
I think you've hit it off with him.
Yes, very much so.
The lady's husband steps closer. He gives the collar of his suit jacket a quick tug so that it's good and straight.
Perhaps we should chat a bit. Certainly arrangements can be made so that...
Quite possibly.
Miss Tan doesn't wait for him to finish.
But I must warn you, this little darling is definitely a popular one. I've had several ask after him already. Those lovely blue eyes with the dark lashes and the golden curls. Such a rarity. Like a little angel. He could charm most any mother's heart.
They all look at my brother. The man reaches across and pinches Gabby's cheek, and he baby laughs real cute. He hasn't giggled like that since the police took us off the Arcadia. I'm glad he's happy. Even if it's just for today.
Take the other children outside.
Miss Tan's voice goes low and flat. She leans close to Mrs. Pulnick and whispers through her teeth.
Put them in the cars. Wait 5 minutes there before you let the driver pull away.
Even a little lower, she adds.
But I don't think we'll be needing you.
Mrs. Pulnick clears her throat and uses a friendly, happy voice we never hear at Mrs. Murphy's house.
To the cars with all of you. Come along.
Lark, Stevie, and the other kids scurry to the porch. Fern kicks her feet against my leg and rocks on my hip like she's trying to make a stubborn pony walk out of the barn.
But get... Robbie.
Roots grow under my feet, and I'm not even sure why at first. The people just want to hug and kiss on Gabby a little more. They like to play with little boys. I've been keeping an eye on Gabby, Lark, and Fern all day, whenever I could get away from the couple of men who wanted to know who I was and why I was here, since I'm older than everybody else. I've scampered from room to room and window to window, making sure I knew where the babies were and that nobody was being mean to them. But in the back of my mind, I've been thinking about Stevie's sister, who left Mrs. Murphy's house and never came back. I know what happens to orphans, which Sherry and Stevie are, but we're not. We've got a daddy and a mama who are coming back for us. Does the woman who's been playing with Gabian know that? Did anybody tell her? She doesn't think he's an orphan, does she? I take another step toward my brother. Here, I can get him. The woman turns her shoulder to me. He's fine. Outside! Mrs. Pulnick's fingers close hard around my arm. And I know what'll happen if I don't do what she asks. I touch Gabby's little knee and say, It's all right. The lady just wants to tell you bye-bye. He lifts a fat little hand and waves at me. Bye-bye, he repeats. His smile fills with baby teeth. I remember when he cut every single one of those. To the car! Mrs. Pulnick's jagged fingernails dig into my skin. She tugs me, and I trip over the threshold on the way out, staggering onto the porch and almost dropping Fern. Oh, goodness, is she his sister? The woman with Gabian worries. No, certainly not, Miss Tan says, lying again. The little ones become attached to the older ones in the home. That is all. It can't be helped. They forget just as quickly, of course. The only sibling to this little fellow is an infant girl, newborn, adopted by a very prominent family, no less. So you can see that he is no ordinary little boy. You've picked out our finest. The mother was a college graduate, an extremely intelligent girl. Died during the birthing process, unfortunately, and the children were abandoned by their father. But they're no worse for the wear. And wouldn't this one be adorable on your California beaches? Of course, our out-of-state adoptions do involve special fees. Those are the last words I hear before Mrs. Pulnick drags me down the porch steps, telling me under her breath what Mrs. Murphy will do to me if I don't step it up. Her grip wrenches my arm until I'm sure it's going to break. I don't even care. I can't feel anything. Not the summer dry grass crunching under my feet. Not the stiff shoes the workers gave me this morning. Not the hot, sticky evening air, or the too tight dress tugging when Fern kicks and wiggles and reaches over my shoulder, whimpering, Gabby, Gabby. I'm cold on the outside, like I just fell off in the winter river, and all the blood's gone deep down inside to try to keep me from freezing to death. My arms and legs seem like they're somebody else's. They move, but only because they know what they're supposed to do, not because I tell them. Mrs. Pulnick throws Fern and me in the car with the rest of the kids, and gets in beside me. I sit stiff and stare toward the big house, and wait for the door to open, and someone to bring Gabian across the yard. I wish for it so hard the wishing hurts.
Where's Gabby?
Fern whispers into my ear, and Lark watches me with her sad, quiet eyes. She hasn't said much since we came to Mrs. Murphy's, and she won't now either, but I still hear her. You gotta get Gabian, she's telling me. I picture him coming across the yard. I hope. I watch. I try to think.
What should I do?
Mrs. Pulnick's wristwatch ticks. Tick, 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 tick. Miss Tan's words flit through my mind, zipping off the way water striders do when someone throws a rock in the river. They go all directions at once. Died during the birthing process.
My mama's dead?
The children were abandoned.
Briny's not coming back for us?
The only sibling to this little fellow is an infant girl, newborn.
One of the babies didn't die at the hospital? I have a new little sister?
Miss Tan gave her to somebody? Is that a lie? Is all of it a lie? Miss Tan can tell a fib so smooth and easy, it seems like even she believes it. Gabby doesn't have a mama who's a college student. Queenie's smart, but she only got through the 8th grade before she met Branny and took off for the river. It's lies, I tell myself. Everything she says is a lie. It's gotta be. She's trying to make the party people happy. But they'll have to give Gabriel back because Miss Tan knows our daddy's coming to get us soon's he can. Branny would never give us up. He'd never let a lady like Miss Tan take my new baby sister if I had one. Never. Ever. He'd die first. Is Branny dead? Is that why he hasn't come for us? The car starts, and I jerk toward the window, pushing Fern off my lap. She slides into the seat as I grab hold of the door handle. I'll run back to the house, and I'll tell those people the truth. I'll tell them Miss Tan is a liar. I don't care what they do to me after. Before anything else can happen, Mrs. Pulnick has me by the big fancy hair bow one of the workers prettied me up with this morning. Fern squirms out from between us and lands on the floor with Stevie and Lark.
You will behave!
Mrs. Pulnick's lips touch my ear, her breath hot and sour. It smells of Mrs. Murphy's whiskey.
Should you not? Mrs. Murphy will give you the closet. And not only will this be for you, we will be tying all of you and leaving you there, hanging like shoes by the laces. The closet is cold, and it is dark. Will the little ones enjoy the dark, do you think?
My heart beats wild as she yanks my head back. My neck crackles and snaps. Hair pops loose from the roots. A white flash of pain shoots over my eyes.
Is that understood?
I do my best to nod. She throws me against the door, and my head bounces off the glass.
I did not imagine any troubles would be coming from you.
Tears storm into my eyes, and I blink hard against them. I won't cry. I won't. The seat bends, sucking me closer to Mrs. Pulnick's bulky body. She lets out a purring sigh, like a cat in a sunny chair.
Driver, take us to home now. It is time.
I worm away and watch out the window as long as I can, until the white house with its big columns is gone. Nobody in the car says a word. Fern crawls back into my lap, and we all sit still as stones. On the way back to Mrs. Murphy's, I look for the river. A little dream finds its way into my mind, while Fern hangs on around my neck, and Lark rests against my knee. And Stevie huddles between my feet, his fingers squeezed over the buckles on my shoes. I pretend that when we pass by the river, the Arcadia will be there, and Briny will see the car. In my daydream, he runs up the banks and makes the driver stop. Briny opens the door and pulls us out, all of us, even Stevie. When Mrs. Pulnick tries to get in his way, he slugs her in the nose, just like he would if someone tried to steal from him in a pool hall. Branny kidnaps us the way Huck Finn's daddy does in the story. But Huck's daddy was a bad man, and Branny is good. He goes back to the house and gets Gabian away from Miss Tan, and carries us to a far-off place. But my dream isn't true. The river comes and goes. There's no sign of the Arcadia. And soon enough, the shadow of Mrs. Murphy's house covers the car. Inside my skin, I'm empty and cold, like the Indian caves where Branny took us camping one time when we hiked up over the bluffs. There were bones in the caves, dead bones of people who are gone. There are dead bones in me. Real Foss can't breathe in this place. She doesn't live here. Only May Weathers does. Real Foss lives down on the river. She's the princess of Kingdom Arcadia. It's when we're marching up Mrs. Murphy's sidewalk that I think about Camellia. I feel guilty for imagining that Branny rescued us from the car, that he took us away without Camellia. I'm scared of what she'll say when I tell her we haven't got Gabian with us, that I hope he's coming later on. Camellia will say I should have fought harder, that I should have bit and scratched and screamed the way she would have. Maybe that's right. Maybe I deserve to hear it. Could be I'm just too chicken. But I don't want to get the closet. I don't want them to put my little sisters in there either. Dread steals over me when we get inside. It's the kind of dread that comes on a swolled-up river when the spring melt happens and you see an ice floe headed straight for the boat. Sometimes, the ice is so big that you know there's no chance of pushing it away with a boat hook. It's about to hit, and hit hard. And if the edge slices the hull, you're sunk. It's all I can do not to shake off the babies and turn around and run out Mrs. Murphy's door before it closes behind us. The house stinks of mold and bathroom smells and Mrs. Murphy's perfume and whiskey. The smells grab me by the throat, and I can't breathe. And I'm glad when we're told to go outside because the kids haven't come in for supper yet.
"And the clothes are not to be soiled," Mrs. Polnick hollers after us.
I look for Camilla in the places where I told her to stay, the safe places. She's not at any of them. The big boys don't answer when I ask where she is. They just shrug and go on playing a game of Conkers with the Buckeyes they pick by the back fence. Camellia's not digging in the dirt, or swinging on the swings, or playing house in the shade under the trees. All the other kids are here, but not Camilla. For the second time in one day, my heart feels like it'll bust out of my chest. What if they've taken her away? What if she threw a fit after we left, and she got herself in trouble?
"Camilla!"
I holler, and then listen. But there are only the voices of the other kids. My sister doesn't answer.
"Camilla!"
I'm headed for the side of the house, for the azalea bushes, when I see her. She's sitting on the corner of the porch, with her legs pulled tight to her chest, and her face buried. Her black hair and her skin are gray with dirt. It looks like she's been in a scrape with somebody while I was gone. There's scratches on her arm, and she's got a skinned knee. Maybe that's why the big boys wouldn't tell me where she was. Probably they're the ones she tangled with. I leave the little kids by the persimmons and tell them to stay right there and not to wander. And I go up the stairs and walk down the long porch to Camilla. My stiff shoes echo against the wood. Clack, clack, clack. But my sister never moves. "Camilla?" Sitting would get my dress dirty, so I squat down beside her. Maybe she's sleeping. "Camilla, I brought you something. It's in my pocket. Let's go out on the hill where nobody can see, and I'll give it to you." She doesn't answer. I touch her hair, and she jerks away. A little gray cloud puffs out as my hand slides toward her shoulder. It smells like ashes, but not like a fireplace exactly. I know the smell, except I can't place it. "What'd you get yourself into while we were gone?" I touch her again, and she ducks her shoulder in, but lifts her head. She's got a bump on her lip, and there are four round bruises on her chin. Her eyes are puffy and red, like she's been crying. But it's the look inside them that bothers me most. It's like I'm staring through a window into an empty room. There's nothing inside but the dark. The smell comes off her again, and all of a sudden I know it. Coal ash. Whenever we tied up the Arcadia near railroad tracks, we'd gather up coal that had fallen off the trains. "Heating and cooking, free for the taking," Briny always said. "Has Briny been here?" As soon as I think it, I know how wrong I am. I know how wrong this is. Something terrible happened while I was gone. "What's the matter?" I drop down to the porch, too scared to care about my dress. Little splinters poke my legs. "Camilla, what happened?" Her lips hang open but don't make a sound. A tear squeezes from her eye and cuts a pink river through the coal dust.
Tell me.
I lean down to see her better, but she turns and stares the other way. Her hand is knotted in a fist between us. I take it in mine, pry open her fingers to see what she's holding. And the minute I do, all the cookies and ice cream from the party come up in my throat. Dirty round peppermints are stuck so tight to my sister's palm, they're melted into her skin. I close my eyes and shake my head, and try not to know, but I do. My mind drags me kicking and screaming to Mrs. Murphy's cellar, into the dark corner behind the stairs, where ash coats the coal bin and the boiler furnace. I see thin, strong arms fighting, legs thrashing around. I see a big hand closing over a screaming mouth, the dirty, oily fingers squeezing so hard they leave four round bruises. I want to run in the house, yell and scream. I want to smack Camellia for being stubborn and going over by the azaleas when I told her not to. I want to grab her and hold her close and make everything better. I don't know exactly what Riggs did to her, but I know it's bad. I also know that if we tell, he'll make my sister fall out of a tree and hit her head. Maybe he'll even do the same to me. Then who will take care of the babies? Who will wait for Gabian to come back? I grab my sister's hand, slap away the peppermints, and let them bounce onto the porch and fall into the flower bed, where they disappear under a trumpet vine. She doesn't fight when I pull her to her feet. Come on. If they see you looking like this when the dinner bell rings, they'll think you've been fighting, and you'll get the closet. I drag her down the porch like a tow sack of wheat and haul her to the rain barrel, and little by little, pour the water over her skin and wash her off best I can. You tell them you fell off the swing. Even though I'm holding her face in my hands, she won't look at me. You hear? Anybody asks about the skin places, you say you fell off the swing, and that's all. Over on the steps, Fern and Lark and Stevie wait for us, quiet as mice. Y'all stay put and leave Camellia be, I tell them. She ain't feeling good.
Your tummy hurt?
Fern saddles closer, and so does Lark, and Camellia pushes them away hard. Lark looks at me confused. She's usually the only one Camellia does like. Let her alone, I said.
I see London, I see France, one of the big boys hollers from halfway across the yard.
They always start wandering in about now, so they can be first in the supper line. I don't know why. We all get the same thing every single meal.
You hush up, Danny boy,
I hiss, and pull Camellia's dress down over her knees. The workers call him Danny Boy on account of he's Irish. Red hair and 1,000 freckles. Just like James had. He marshals their pack now that James is gone. But Danny Boy is mean to the core. He wanders closer, props his hands on the rope that's holding up his two big britches.
Well, ain't you fine and fancy? Guess even them purty clothes couldn't get you no new mama and daddy.
We don't need a mama and daddy. We got one.
Who'd want you anyhow?
He catches sight of Camellia's scratched up arm and leg, pushes in closer to see.
What happened to her? Looks like she's been fighting.
I step up to Danny Boy. If I have to get the closet to protect my sister, I will.
She fell down and bunged herself around a little. That's all. You got anything to say about it?
The dinner bell rings, and we line up before anything else can happen. Turns out that evening it's not me getting the closet I need to worry about. It's Camellia. She's quiet through supper and doesn't eat her food. But when it's time for the bath, she comes alive and throws a wild-eyed fit. She screams like an animal and scratches and kicks and leaves long red fingernail marks on Mrs. Pulnick's arm. It takes three workers to hold Camellia down and drag her to the bathroom. By then, Mrs. Pulnick has me by the hair, too.
You are not to speak, Not one word, or you will see the consequence.
Fern, Lark, and Stevie cling to each other against the wall. In the bathroom, Camellia roars and squeals. Water splashes. A bottle shatters. Scrub brushes clatter. The door shakes in its frame.
Riggs! Mrs. Polnick yells down the stairs. Come with my rope! Bring my rope for the closet!
And just like that, Camellia's gone. The last thing I see of her is a worker hauling her off down the hall, caterpillar wrapped in a bedsheet so she can't kick or hit. That night, we're just three. I don't take out our book to read it, and my baby sisters don't beg for more of the story. Lark and Fern and me curl up in one cot together, and I hum one of Queenie's old songs until my sisters fall asleep. Finally, I drift away, too. Sometime before sunup, Fern wets the bed for the first time since she was 2 and a half. I don't even holler at her for it. I just clean it up the best I can and open the basement window the little crack it'll go. I roll up the wet blanket in Fern's drawers and stick them under the bushes where hopefully nobody will find them. I'll sneak through the azaleas later and spread them out so they'll dry before tonight. It's when I'm working to spread the blanket over the branches that the wind catches the leaves, and they shudder apart long enough for me to see something. Underneath the gaslight by the street, there are people standing and watching the house. In the dawn dark, I can't make out faces or clothes. Just the outline of a crooked old man and a tall, thin boy. They look like Zed and Silas. Just as quick as they were there, the leaves fall back, and they're gone.
Chapter 15. Avery. The envelope is surprisingly ordinary. Just the plain manila kind that would be used in an office. The contents feel thin. Maybe a few sheets of paper, folded in triplicate. It's sealed shut, and my grandmother's name is written on the back in a shaky scrawl that bleeds across to the margin and drops over the edge.
Granddad's Parkinson's gave him quite a bit of trouble toward the end,
Trent explains. He rubs his forehead, frowning at the envelope as if he's wondering again whether he should have broken the oath by giving it to me. I know I'd be wise to open it before he changes his mind, but guilt stings. Trent looks as if he's failed at something. I'm the cause of that. I understand loyalty to family all too well. It's the very thing that has driven me here in the middle of the night. Thank you, I say, as if that will help. He kneads an eyebrow with his fingertips and nods reluctantly.
Just so you know, it may make things worse, not better. There was a reason my granddad spent so much of his time helping to find people. After he and my gran married and took over the family business in Charleston, he went to law school so he could handle his own real estate contracts. But he also did it for another reason. When he was 18, he'd found out he was adopted. Nobody had ever told him. His adoptive father was a sergeant in the Memphis Police Department, and I don't know that they were ever very close. But when Granddad learned he'd been lied to all his life, that was the last straw. He joined the army the next day and never talked to his adoptive parents again. He looked for his birth family for years, but never found them. My gran always felt like it might have been better if he hadn't run across his records in the first place. To tell you the truth, she wished his adoptive parents had destroyed them.
Secrets have a way of coming out. That's a bit of wisdom my father has shared with me many times.
Secrets also make you vulnerable to your enemies, political or otherwise.
Whatever's inside this envelope, I'm better off knowing it. Still, my fingers tremble as I slip them beneath the flap. I can see why your grandfather would have been passionate about helping other people find information and lost family members.
But how is my grandmother involved?
The adhesive loosens bit by bit as I pull. I work it slowly, like my mother opening a birthday present, taking care not to tear the paper. Guess there's no time like the present to find out, I say. Gingerly, I remove a smaller envelope that has been opened at some time in the past. The papers inside are folded together like a brochure or an electric bill, but I can tell they're official documents of some kind. Across the table, Trent looks down at his hands as I lay out the contents. There's no point in thanking him again. It won't save him from wrestling with his conscience. I want you to know you can count on me to do whatever's best with this. I won't let it cause some kind of family issue. I respect your grandfather's concern, given the kind of research he was doing for people.
He knew firsthand what could happen.
A noise in the house causes both of us to turn as I'm flattening the documents on the table. I recognize the sound of little bedtime feet on a sandy floor. I halfway expect to see one of my nieces or nephews standing in the corridor, but instead there's a 3- or 4-year-old tow-headed boy with sleepy blue eyes and the most adorable cleft in his chin. I know where he got that. Trent Turner has a son. Is there a Mrs. Turner sleeping back there? The strangest hint of disappointment tinges the thought a faint shade of green. I catch myself checking for a wedding ring before looking back at the little boy and thinking, "Stop that! Avery Stafford, what is wrong with you?" It's times like this that I wonder what really is wrong with me. Why don't I feel like a woman who has bonded with her soulmate forever and ever? End of story. Both of my sisters fell head over heels for their husbands and seemingly never had any second thoughts. So did my mother. So did my grandmother. The little boy eyeballs me as he circles the table, yawning and scratching his forehead with the back of one arm. He's dramatic about it. He looks like a silent movie actress practicing an exaggerated swoon.
"Are you supposed to be in bed, Jonah?" his dad asks.
"Yeah."
"And you're up because?"
Trent may be trying to sound tough, but his face has pushover written on it. Jonah braces both hands on his daddy's knee, lifts a leg, and begins to climb him like a jungle gym. Trent hoists the boy up, and Jonah stretches closer to whisper,
"Is a pterodactyl in my closet."
"A pterodactyl?"
"Yeah."
"Jonah, there's nothing in your closet. That's just the movie the big kids let you watch over at Aunt Lou's, remember? You've had another bad dream about it. A dinosaur wouldn't even fit in your closet. There are no dinosaurs in there."
"Yeah,"
Jonah sniffs. Clinging to handfuls of his dad's t-shirt, he swivels enough to study me over a wide-open yawn. I shouldn't get involved. I might be just making things worse. I have, however, been through this dinosaur thing during holiday sleepovers at Drayden Hill and vacations with my sister's kids. My nieces and nephews had the same problem. They were scared of dinosaurs, too. But do you know what we did? Jonah shakes his head, and Trent gives me a quizzical look, sandy blonde brows twisting together. He has a very flexible forehead. Two identical sets of blue eyes invite my solution to the closet dinosaur dilemma. Fortunately, I have one. We went to the store the next day and picked out flashlights. Really awesome flashlights. If you've got a really awesome flashlight by your bed, then when you wake up at night and you think you see something, you can turn on the light and shine it over there and check. And do you know what happens every single time when you turn on the flashlight? Jonah waits breathless, his little Cupid's bow mouth hanging open. But Dad clearly knows the answer. He looks like he wants to palm-thump himself in the forehead, as if to say, "Why didn't I think of this before?"
Every single time when you shine the flashlight, nothing's there.
Every time?
Jonah's not sure. Always. Honest. Jonah turns to his father for confirmation, and a sweet look of trust passes between them. This is obviously an involved dad. He slays monsters and does tuck-in time.
We'll go pick out a flashlight tomorrow at the Bilo. Sound good?
I notice he doesn't say, "Mom can take you to get a flashlight tomorrow." I also notice that he doesn't tell his son to be a big boy or insist on hustling the poor kid back to bed. He just shifts Jonah to one shoulder and lays a palm on the table, the fingers pointing toward the documents pressed beneath my hand. Jonah pops a thumb into his mouth and snuggles against his dad's chest. I look down at the papers, surprised that they temporarily left my mind. Jonah is irresistibly cute. The top page is a grainy photocopy of some sort of official form. History sheet, the heading reads in bold black letters. Below, the subject has been given a number of record, 7501. Age, infant. Sex, male. The baby's name is listed as Shad Arthur Foss, church relationships unknown. The corner of the form is stamped with a date in October 1939 and was apparently filled out at a hospital in Memphis, Tennessee. Mother's name, Mary Ann Anthony. Father's name, B.A. Foss. The address for both parents is listed as Indigent, River Camp. Both the father and mother were in their late 20s when the baby was born. The official responsible for the form, Miss Eugenia Carter, has explained the infant's situation in a few short words under clinical-sounding headings. Cause for release to TCH Society. Born out of wedlock. Unable to provide. How released. Surrender signed by mother and father at birth. I don't recognize these names, I mutter, separating the sheet from the others and setting it quietly on the table. Granted, we have a lot of relatives, but I've never seen a Foss or an Anthony on a wedding invitation or met one at a funeral. I can't imagine how any of this could be connected to my grandmother. This might have been around the year she was born, I guess. Grandma Judy's age changes every time you ask her. She admits to nothing and considers it gauche for anyone to inquire in the first place. Maybe Shad Arthur Foss was someone she knew in school later? Could she have been trying to help a friend track down birth information? The next page is a copy of a case history sheet on baby boy Foss. Birth date, September 1st, 1939. Birth weight, premature, 4 pounds. Present weight, 6 pounds, 9 ounces. Baby. Baby arrived prematurely, weighing only 4 pounds at birth. He has developed normally in every way. Conn was negative. Wasserman and smear on mother were negative. Has had no childhood illnesses or immunizations. Mother, 28 years of age, American-born, of Polish-Dutch extraction. High school education, blue eyes, blonde hair, about 5'6" tall. Weight, 115 pounds. Protestant in religion. Considered very attractive and intelligent. Father, 29 years of age, American-born, of Scotch-Irish and Cajun-French extraction. High school education, brown eyes, black hair, about 6'1" tall. Weight about 175 pounds. No church affiliation. No inheritable diseases exist on either side among the families, and despite extramarital errors of these young individuals, both maternal and paternal families are hardworking and well-respected in their own communities. None have interest in custody of the children. I pass the second document across the table to Trent, who's looking at the first one. The third page reads, Parents or Guardians Surrender to Tennessee Children's Home Society. Help a child find a home is our motto. Baby Shad's sad story is told again in uneven type on dashed lines beside questions like healthy, robust, deformed, crippled, diseased, is child ruptured, is child feeble-minded, fit to be placed in a home. Baby Shad is signed, sealed, witnessed, and delivered. He's transferred to the Memphis receiving home for observation and placement. I really haven't a clue what any of this means. But I do know there's no way my grandmother would have come here to Edisto repeatedly to meet with Trent Turner Sr. if it weren't important. I also find it hard to believe that she would have gone this far to help a friend. She had some personal investment here. Are there more of these packets? Did your grandfather leave anything else? Trent looks away as if he's trying to decide what to tell me, struggling with his conscience again. Finally, he offers, Just a few other sealed envelopes with names on them, like that one. Most of the papers Granddad was able to give to the owners before he passed on. The packets that were left, he pretty much figured were for people who'd died without his knowing it. Trent pauses to shift Jonah, who's falling asleep on his shoulder. Some cases he kept up with for 50 and 60 years, ever since he started doing the research. How he decided which ones to take on, I don't know. I never asked him. I vaguely remember clients coming to him with pictures and sitting at the table in the little cottage outside, crying and talking. But it didn't happen all that often. He did most of his business at the office in Charleston. The only reason I ever saw any of it was that I came here to Edisto with him every chance I got. Once in a while, he'd meet with people here. For privacy, I think. I have a feeling he dealt with some pretty high-profile clients on occasion. He gives me a meaningful look, and I know he's lumping me into that category. My skin suddenly itches, and I squirm under my t-shirt. I'm still at a loss as to what this has to do with my grandmother. Is there anything in your grandfather's papers having to do with a woman named May Crandall, or maybe even someone named Fern, or Queenie? I think they might have been friends of my grandmother. He rests his chin on Jonah's downy head.
The names don't sound familiar, but like I told you earlier, I didn't go back and read any of the documents after Granddad died. I locked his workshop, and I haven't been in there since.
A shrug indicates the tiny cabin slumbering beneath the glow of a yard lamp.
I just took charge of the envelopes, like he asked me to. Whatever else was left out there, I assumed he didn't think was important anymore. He had a lot of respect for people's privacy, given what he went through when he found out the truth about his parents. He never wanted to take the responsibility of altering someone else's history that way. Not unless they asked for the information.
So that means my grandmother definitely came to him?
Based on what I know about my grandfather's work, yes.
He worries his bottom lip contemplatively. I catch myself focusing in on it, almost losing track of what he's saying.
If someone else had been looking for your grandmother, a lost relative, say, Granddad would have given them the paperwork and closed out the file once he'd found your grandmother. He always let his clients make the final decisions about getting in touch. The fact that he hadn't closed this file and that he'd left it marked Judy Stafford means that your grandmother was looking for someone. A person he wasn't ever able to find.
My mind is in hyperdrive now, despite the late hour. Is there any way I could see the rest of it? I know how bold it is to request this now, but I'm afraid Trent may change his mind once he's had time to think about things. A lesson from trial law. If you need your witness to switch tracks, ask for a recess. If not, keep driving hard toward whatever you're after.
Believe me, you don't want to go out there at night. That building is an old slave cabin that was moved onto the property.